You're very welcome to the latest edition of the Greg Hughes podcast. And before we get into it, a big thank you to all of you who've become regular downloaders, regular listeners, and have seen us rocket up the charts on both Spotify and Apple Podcasts and other platforms. Really, we do appreciate it. Well, today's guest, we are diving deep into a political journey that spanned over three decades, shaping the landscape of Donegal and national politics. My guest today spent 34 years representing the people of Donegal South West in Dáil-Éireann, but before he ever stepped foot in Leinster House, he was a teacher rooted in the community at Bunbeg National School. First elected in the turbulent political landscape of 1982, he went on to serve under multiple Taoiseach, eventually taking on the role of Minister of State for Gaeltacht Affairs. We'll talk about the transition from the classroom to the corridors of power, the changing face of Irish politics, the relentless nature of the campaign trail, and how he reflects on life and leadership since retiring in 2016. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome to the podcast my guest today, Dinny McGinley. Now, I'm genuinely delighted to welcome on to the podcast a legend of Donegal politics, national politics, in fact. It is former Fine Gael politician Dinny McGinley. Former Fine Gael, are you former? You're still a member of Fine Gael, are you?
I'm still a member of Fine Gael, Greg, but I'm not active anymore. I'm at a stage of life now where I decided, you know, that should go to some other people coming along. So a member, but...
But you made that decision before and reversed that decision. We might talk about that a little later on.
Oh, yeah, indeed, yes.
But
yeah.
when you look at politics now, Dinny, and, you know, you see all the social media stuff. Now, you might not necessarily be on social media, but you see the way politics is covered and you see the level of scrutiny and all that type of stuff. I mean, sometimes it feels like a fool's game.
Completely different than when I entered politics for the first time about 1980. That's 46 years ago. And so many things have changed. You have, at that time, you didn't have any local radio, for instance. You didn't have any internet. You didn't have any mobile phones. And now you have the social media thing completely changed. Don't know whether it's better or the worst. Maybe for the better, probably, you know, communications are easier. And I remember, you know, when I started off to get, you wanted to get your name into the local papers every weekend.
Yeah, that was the big win.
And coming from Dublin, always on Thursday night, I used to call down to into Letterkenny down there, Crossview House. John McGrory, God rest him, was editor of the Derry People at the time, and he'd have the tea ready. Strong tea, I must say, and he always had the cigarette in the hand, and I'd give him a few lines anyway, and you'd have in the paper the following morning. And that's how you kept in contact with the people through the local press. But now we have Highland Radio, and you have the internet, and you have social media of every kind. So yeah, it's easier that way.
I'm not sure, as even as someone who works in it and contributes to it, I'm not sure we're better off, because I'm not really even sure it's led to a greater scrutiny of politics or politicians. I think the good that could have come from it, particularly the internet I'm talking of now, has kind of been lost because people are so divided in their views now.
Absolutely. And I'm absolutely glad that I'm not in politics anymore. I'm not a public figure anymore, because they can't say anything about you and you have no comeback. I think that needs to be looked at, you know. I think they're looking at that at the moment, how they can control that, particularly when it comes to the protection of children and all that. It's a very controversial area, and I know the ministers of the government are looking at that at the moment.
As we record this, a couple of weeks out from Donegal versus Cork, in the next stage of the GEA Championship, you have a bit of a connection to both counties, a very strong connection to Donegal. But were you educated or born in Cork?
I was born in Donegal.
Okay.
I was born in Gidor, where I lived all my life. And now, at that time, there were no secondary schools in Donegal.
Right.
When I was leaving school in the mid-50s. But there was a system called the preparatory system that was established when the Free State was established in the early 20s. And people there, one of their aims was to revival of the Irish language. And there were a number of ministers there. They said, how are we going to do this? And the only way they could thought they could do it was through the education system. And they established these preparatory colleges where there were young boys and young girls in through an examination, a very competitive examination, if I may say so. And you spent 4 years or 5 years, did your leavings out, went to teacher training. And the theory was, you went into the schools then, we were all very fluent Irish speakers, and lo and behold, in a generation or two, Ireland would be Irish speaking. In theory, it was okay, but in practice, it didn't work
out. But it was a plan, and it was a firm plan, whether it worked or not, obviously.
It was a plan, yeah, and they meant very well. Number of ministers there, Owen McNeill was one of them. Michael McDougall's grandfather, in fact, right. You know, who you had him in here a number of times. Ernest Blythe, he was a northern man, northern Protestant indeed, a minister of the government, but very committed to the Irish language. Dick Mulcahy, that's what they thought. And they established five or six colleges, three for girls and two for boys. The girls' colleges was one in Filcarra, one in Turmacady in Mayo, and one in Dingle in County Kerry, and two for boys, one in Galway, St Enda's, and one in Ballyvourney, College Isigan, they called it. And there was a sixth college, by the way. There was a sixth preparatory college for the Protestant community, and that was in Dublin, St. Mavis.
So where did you attend then?
I was fortunate that when I went to school in Knockestoller, Bunbeg, we had a teacher there who specialised in preparing students for this examination. And he had pupils from all over the country there. People like Sean McCaig, a former president of the GAA, you mentioned the GAA there, and others, and they did the examination, and if you were successful, so we got the examination anyway. It was successful, I got it, as did my brother as well, and we had just a choice of two places, Galway or Cork. Now, there was some controversy with Galway, St Enda's. A number of Donegal students were expelled for some reason or other from Galway. And our teacher said, you're better off going to Cork and they'd be appreciated down there. So we used to go to Cork the beginning of September and you get home for the first time at Christmas. And the first few years there, you'd go back there in January and you wouldn't get home for the summer holidays.
Unbelievable. And what age did you go down there at?
13 years of age,
and
Greg.
This was, the plan was to be a teacher.
The plan was to be a teacher.
Well, that's a big, we talk about big decisions young ones have to make now, but you were choosing your career path effectively with the support of your family at 13?
13, yeah.
Wow, that's what well
it,
done.
Well, that was there were very few other exits. There were few other opportunities. The only other secondary school we had for boys at that time was St Union's here in Letterkenny. Mm. I did that exam and I got the scholarship, but we decided on Cork instead because it always guaranteed you a path into teaching. And so many people from Western Donegal, from my own area, from the Gaeltacht, and other parts of Donegal availed of that opportunity and became teachers. So there are teachers from Donegal all over the country.
Wow.
All over the country.
You also had to do some time in Dublin as well, though, did you, as part of your studies?
Yes.
I mean, obviously that would have been after your leaving cert, etc.
Yes, my first job was in Dublin. At 20 years of age, I became a teacher in Inchicore. I remember the day very well, the 17th of June, 63. Went into a class there in Bluebell. 54 boys in the class. I didn't even have a classroom. At the other end of the assembly hall was a similar class for girls. So I went in at the very deep end. And I tell you, when you spend a number of years teaching in a place like Bluebell in Dublin, you'll meet any challenge in any other school that you may go to in Ireland.
Yeah.
And then I dedicated my time in Dublin. Then I spent 4 years at UCD where I did my degree and my HDIP, which, you know, I was glad to have the opportunity to do that.
Was it always your intention to come home and teach?
Well, I didn't have any definite plans there, and I was 72. There was a school, Ranafast.
Mm-hmm.
It was closed at the time, and very controversial at the time, closed to the rural schools. And the people of Ranafast had a big campaign going that they wanted to reopen the school.
What was the controversy, Denny, if you don't mind asking?
Well, they didn't want their little school in the community to be closed,
okay, yeah,
because they thought it would be a backward step for the community, and I would agree with that.
Mm.
And anyway, the decision was made eventually that it should be reopened, and I remember the parish priest of Argy at the time your man that you probably remember here, and Thar O'Nofriel.
Father O'Nofriel,
and,
of course.
Yeah. I remember meeting him in Dublin. He wanted to see me. Went to the Skyline Hotel, met him there, and he said they were open to the school and he wanted me to come down and he would take on the job as principal of the school, which I gave it such careful consideration. My brothers were away from home. My brother was teaching in Dublin, other people somewhere. There were teachers anyway. And my father and mother were getting old and I said, I'll come home.
Yeah.
And I decided to come home at that time. And I spent about 9 months on Ranafast. And then my old school in Bunbeg came up. The principal, Johnny McGinley, Sean McGinley, a very famous teacher all over the country, prepared us all for the examination. He was retiring. And I remember Canon McGettigan coming to me. I was outside the house. It was just after Christmas doing something. He said, I want you, would you be to appoint you as principal of Bunbeg? That's how it was done in those days, you see. And I said, I can't do that. I said, Father O'Nofriel would hang me for that. Don't you worry, leave him, I'll deal with him. So I ended up then as principal of my own school.
But what did Father O'Nofriel think of this decision, I wonder?
I think he understood. Yeah. He was he's a man of the world and he understood. Yeah. He did.
Did you know Father O'Nofriel well?
I knew him very well. Yeah. Well, I knew him. Well, he was from Gidor, of course. Yes. And he was my manager while we were in Ranafast.
Okay.
And I had Pat McGarvey there with me as well, who took over principal when I left. He's still hale and hearty. And Margaret Richardson. Margaret is, she's in Dunfermline at the Lakeview there now. But we got on very well, the three of us.
I just wonder, because I got to know him really quite well later in his life. Was he always such a straight shooter, you know, whereby he just said what he thought?
Absolutely, you know, he certainly was. Yeah, he did have the reputation, all right. But okay. I must say that I got on very well with him. Yeah.
I loved it. No, I'm saying that as a compliment. I loved that side of his personality.
Yes, he did,
Okay. So then, what year roughly did you take up the role in Bunbeg, Denis?
73.
Okay.
April 73.
So we're not far away then for your...
January 73.
Okay. So we're not far away then, I presume, before the politics became a feature here, because you were elected early 80s, right? But I presume there was a lead into that. Had you an interest in elected politics at that time in the early 70s?
No, not in elected politics at all. I was very happy with my lot. I had principal. I had a nice school there. Would you believe it? We had over 200 pupils there at the time.
Wow.
And there were only 5 teachers there, you know. And I remember going into Bunbeg as well. And there was 6th and 7th class there. And some of them were taller than I was and bigger in every way. And but I was very happy there. Very proud of the school and all that sort of thing. I suppose my interest in politics would go back probably, well, to UCD, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
One of my lecturers there at the time was Garrett Fitzgerald, whom I got to know. And I think I was kind of a dormant member of the Fine Gael branch in UCD.
Did Dr. Fitzgerald see anything in you at that time during those conversations? Did he sort of maybe...
Well, I'm not so sure about that, but the opportunity came up in 1980. The late Joe Brennan, Joe Brennan passed away in 1980, and they decided there had to be a by-election, of course. And I remember Paddy Hart came to me, and he wrote me a letter. Still have the letter.
Wow.
And who was incidentally a mentor to me during my years in the Dáil, Paddy. We were very good friends, but asking me would I consider it. And he was saying that he said that he had a word with Gareth Fitzgerald. I don't know. And would I be interested in? Oh, I said no, Paddy. I almost dismissed it. And then they were at me, and a number of local people came as well. You know, when you're a teacher at that time, you'd be involved with the parish council. I was involved with care for the aged. I remember
you're already doing a lot of stuff in the community, I suppose.
Things like that. And used to go to Ballybuffet and first meet another politician who was retired, Ian McGarvey. He was a member of the care for the aged as well. But anyway, I remember one weekend I said I'd have to deal with this, and I took a weekend off, and
Your counsel? Who did you have to...
Fred Call was there.
Yeah.
He was the counsellor.
No, but who did you Who did you trust or want around you to help you with this decision-making process, of, or was it a solo run?
Well, first of all, I had to consult with family members.
Yeah.
My parents, well, my mother was still there, Helen Harty, my two brothers were there. I consulted the local councillor, Fred Call was there. I consulted a number of other people. The late Padraig Doherty, you may have, he passed away, sadly,
that's right,
a few months ago. And they were all saying, oh, yes, why not give it a... there was a man from Lochinure, John Sweeney, people like that. And I don't want to be mentioning too many names.
No, I understand. Uh-huh. But in other words, you took a lot of consideration.
I took a lot of consideration because I had a nice position. I was very happy in it. I was at home and everything was going very well. I enjoyed the school. I enjoyed the teaching and all that sort of thing, and involved in local affairs. And I said, why not give it a try? I have nothing to lose. And that's how it happened.
Yeah.
1980. And it was a by-election, and there were three of us there. I was the late Clement Coughlin, Paddy Kelly, both passed away, unfortunately, God rest them, and myself. And that was the by-election. And I got almost 21,000 votes.
Did that... I mean, how does that feel? How does that feel? Because this all happens in a very, very short period of time.
Okay, yes, yeah.
You go for, and I'm sure you wondered, you know, if I go for it, will I get elected? You never know that, right? But then to have such a huge public endorsement, it must have felt fantastic. But also with that come a great responsibility. Things get very real then, don't they?
That's
an awful lot of people banking on you.
Yeah, I wasn't elected, and then I became a significant figure within the party, if you know what I mean.
For
and
sure.
You know, I'd be looked upon as maybe something for the future. I was only about 37 at the time, much younger than I am now, of course. And then, you know, it went from there. That was the first time I dipped my toes in the political sort of waters.
I mean, obviously, you'd been down in Dublin, you'd been involved in certain things, so you weren't going down to the Dáil wet behind the ears by any stretch of the imagination. But I suppose walking through those doors as an elected representative, what was that like?
Well, I suppose, you know, I went to the Dáil, and most of the people going to the Dáil, they would have come through the local authority, you see.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they would be sort of quite, they'd know how to do things.
Yeah.
They'd know the ins and outs of it and all that. But I went there, as I said, it was all new to me. And but I took to it, you had to take to it, you know. And you go into the deep end. And I remember I was only there 1 week or two when I started my first clinics in Chrysla. You know, the Saturday morning, Chrysla, started the first clinic in the first or second week, and it went on from there. But it was great to have been elected, and I never imagined that I would have been.
How soon did it become obvious that, you know, you were, you know, probably being groomed to some extent for some important roles within the party? You know, obviously, you would have made an impression yourself with the geographical considerations at the time as well, to sort of give people, you know, from bench positions, etc., around the country.
Yes, well, I was there for almost 35 years, you know, Greg, and unfortunately, well, it happened. During those years, we were about 25 years in opposition, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
And I suppose my first, the first responsibility I got, I was appointed to the front bench. And I served a number of areas there. Of course, with the Gaeltacht was one of them. I did youth and sport. I did community development. I did defence and so on like that. But being in Fine Gael that time, the opportunities were far fewer than if you were in Fianna Fáil. The two big parties at the time were Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And Fianna Fáil were the dominant party. And Fine Gael only came in, you know, with the assistance of another party when Fianna Fáil didn't get the majority.
Yeah, but all of the portfolios you received, you know, were really relevant to your area. I mean, obviously, you mentioned youth affairs, but the Gaeltacht, of course, the Gaeltacht and emigration, emigrant welfare, of course, which was all I remember talking to you years and years ago about that situation, the islands as well, heritage. You know, you had sort of roles on the front bench, very relevant. Take a drink of that, Dinny. It's only going to go cold on you. You had roles that were very relevant to, you know, your constituency.
Absolutely, that was a great advantage.
Yeah. Because you didn't have to bluff or make things up or learn Irish in a month.
No, definitely not. Yeah, and it sort of dovetailed into my constituency very well, which was a help, you know. And I remember the immigrant thing, we were very involved at the time. I remember going to the States with Simon Coney and Paul Connaughton and Michael Ring, and we went to Washington and, you know, making the case, and, you know, we had an opportunity. I said, I see the White House now, but it's different that time. Once you got in, we were just out in the lawn, passing the time, and went from door to door. I remember we met Ted Kennedy about the immigrants and something to do with them, and the same, we were passing the door of the Senate, and Simon going, that's John McCain, Senator. He's a... And we knocked at the door, and we went. Wow. And we had a great chat him. And he said, "Where?" And I told him Donegal. Oh, he said, "My people came from that area." I said, "I think I do know someone who claims a relationship with you from Ballybuffet, Ivan Knox. He's living there in Ballybuffet." "Yes," he said, "yeah, that was some of my family." So we had a great chat. And the following week, they published that bill to do with Irish immigrants. The Kennedy-McCain bill came to nothing, I think, some of the...
Has the complication with that always been, as it is now, how you separate one immigrant from the other, if you know what I mean? Like, so obviously, there's a far greater number, say, for instance, of immigrants into the United States from the southern border, for an example. And I think it's always been complicated, has it not, to sort of say, right, well... You know, there's a hierarchy of immigrants as such, when effectively they're all illegal, wherever they come from.
They're all, yes, that's right, yeah. And that's where the difficulty is. Very difficult to have a bill for the Irish, except that a number of initiatives were taken. First of all, you had a congressman there, the Donnelly visa. And he succeeded somehow or other are getting so many visas exclusively for Irish people. And I think there was a second one as well, the Donnelly visa. There were a number of initiatives, and that could have been very controversial in the States because, you say, they're from different countries and all that sort of thing. But I do believe that since then, Australia, I think, succeeded.
They did, you're quite correct.
They succeeded in getting something similar to the Irish. Yep. And then you had people like Tip O'Neill, who was also very supportive. You know, the Irish always had great influence in Capitol Hill.
It's interesting, though, isn't it, in such a short period of time, though it's half a lifetime in the context of what we speak in, is that that Irish influence seems to have waned somewhat.
It has.
I think we have one elected representative, you know, with proper Irish links in both houses. I might be mistaken.
Well, of course, you're the obvious. It's Brendan Boyle.
I believe he might be the only one.
His parents have Glenn Colum killed. Father Glenn, his uncle is still, his relations are still there.
But it's changed so significantly, like, oh, you shouldn't go because of this, that, and then, and world affairs and all that type of stuff. And just to hear you talk of quite literally an open door in every office in the White House. How things have changed.
It was easier to get into the White House and get doors than it is in Dáil-Éireann. And once you got past the security, I mean, you could go anywhere and you were passing doors. And yeah, I was amazed at how easy it was. And then when we were finished, we went out and we were around the lawn and nobody paid a bit of attention to us. So I said, God, I said, you know, it's a great privilege to have been able to do that. I don't know if it's still, I don't think it's the same now. I think it's much more stricter.
I believe so. Yeah. You know, you talked about your education started off with an acknowledgement and an initiative to try and enhance and grow the Irish language. Obviously, that would be one of your passions as someone from the Gaeltacht, and you had good positions. Was it frustrating in opposition, though? Because opposition can be great, where you can promise the moon and the stars, but you can't really deliver anything. You can try and influence. Was it a frustrating period of time in politics in opposition whereby you felt like, I'm so close, but...
Yes, of course, you're absolutely right there. You know, as I said before, we were in opposition for 25 years the time I was there. And I was fortunate eventually to have been appointed Minister of State, and I was able to do something significant for the Gaeltacht. I put through the first Gaeltacht Language Act since 1956. And that act established what we call language development areas, Cantar Planalatanga, planning language planning areas, 26 throughout the country, and 7 or 8 of them here in Donegal. And a planning officer was appointed for each area, and they're doing great work now. And it's one of the things that I didn't have many opportunities to put through bills, but that is one that I did succeed. Controversial at the time, but I believe it's very worthwhile now. And there are plans there now, and there are targets set, and so. But that's 10 years ago.
What do you think is the future of the Irish language and its use in Ireland? I mean, obviously, too, we have a very different country in that it's a much even in the north, you know, the old conversation would be Catholics and Protestants. But now the amount of people that wouldn't identify as either or are of different religions, you know, the whole demographic has changed, and the same is happening in the Republic. What do you see? Do you believe that we'll ever get to a point where? Well, how do you see the future of the Irish language?
The most optimistic thing that I see about it is maybe perhaps that most would have a knowledge of the language, and not an acquaintance with the language. And you have now, the beginning of the state and all that sort of thing, maybe we had the wrong approach, you know, it was sort of seen as being compulsory and all that, and it created a lot of not goodwill, the very opposite.
Now we're reaping what we sowed.
But now they're making it more attractive, more emphasis on the spoken word. And then you have the Gael Scullin, and we have them here in Letterkenny and in Donegal, and the young people are taken to it, and they're learning it without any difficulty, without any compulsion. And that's the great hope I see for the language, that they will come to learn it because they like it. It's something that is unique to ourselves, of course. It'd be a terrible pity to lose it. And there are people now who regret when they were going to school that they didn't, and they're sort of becoming interested in it again.
I think we only get there, though, when we figure out how to be proud of our culture and to celebrate it without for fear of offending people, mm-hmm. or to shake off that the English influence that's mm-hmm. with us generationally over centuries. Yeah. You know, sometimes people be afraid to celebrate their Irishness for fear that might offend someone else. And what we see in situations is that other cultures, which is fantastic that we have a diversity here, but they're elevated. Yeah. And it's interesting to see that this is already happening in other countries where there's a bit of a pushback, so that society is truly fair. And I wonder, will we ever get to that point? Do you understand where I'm coming from? Where celebrating our heritage and culture is not seen as detrimental to somebody else.
Absolutely, and that's how it must be. That's how it must be. It can't be any other way. And it's very, but you see now, and down our own part of the county down the west there, you have Ukrainians and Polish and other people, and they're going to the school, and you know, the children, they're able to speak Irish
exactly,
and there's no word about it. Yeah. And you know, and there's great hope there, but I can see that Ireland is going to be an Irish-speaking country, you know. It's difficult to visualise after 100 years of what we've been doing. But at least there is progress now for the reasons that the people associated with, you know, Irishness as part of what we are.
And as you mentioned, you laid a block in those foundations as a junior minister with responsibility for the Gaeltacht. That was 2011, I believe, but that might not never have happened because you were going to chuck it all in. 2006, you weren't going to contest the 2007 general election. Why?
Well, in 2006, I had 25 years in Dáil Éireann, and I was saying, no, I mean, what else can I contribute? And I wanted, whatever time I had left on this planet, I wanted to, you know, be free of the responsibility, and I decided to retire. We had a convention, and my candidate was elected, Terence Lowy, and all that sort of thing. And I remember I was going to the States in December 2006, and I got a phone call from the General Secretary of the party that he wanted, where I told him I was in Dublin going to the States, and said, God, we'd like to meet you. And I met them, and Tom Curran and Frank Flannery, and Kenny was, I think it was the phone maybe, and they told me that they thought there would be difficulty holding the seat. And I said, I'm out of it for a year. Even though I kept doing my clinics and offices opened and all that sort of thing, I promised to stay there and do that and provide the service till my successor was elected. But anyway, to cut a long story short, they were at me and I eventually decided in the month of April or March or April 2007 that I would come back and give it another go. And I went forward.
But you believed you had a better chance of... You believed you had a better chance, though, than Terence Slowey, wasn't it?
Well, they believe that, you know, when a TD retires, there's a vacuum there. It's very difficult sometimes to fill the vacuum.
How did that work between you and Terence, though?
Very well. I said at the convention that my decision to retire would not be vindicated until he was elected. But then things worked out otherwise. And I don't know what polls they carried out. They told me, but that the seat was in danger, and that's why I did come back. And,
but did you, at that time, was part of the plan whereby it was more of a stay for Terence, that he would be your natural successor?
I don't think that arose at all.
You never really thought that far ahead.
No, I went back. I came in 2007, and I was elected. Thanks be to God, I had no difficulty at all. I think I got over 9,500 votes that time, the best election I ever had. And then when 2011 came, there was no word, and I went forward again. But after that, I told Kenny was Taoiseach at the time, that said, "Look," I says, "Look, this is going to be my last election."
Why though? Because I mean, you're in great health. You were in great health then, as far as I'm aware. Mm. You know, still there's a ton of stuff you could do. Why did you feel then was the right time again?
Things have changed, Greg. Yeah. TDs now, people who become TDs now, deputies, after 10 or 15 years or 20 years, they're out. And I have very good friends now. And I have friends now, very good friend
McHugh
of mine.
Joe McHugh pulled the pin quite early.
Paul Coe. He's only 52 or 3. He was in here. I'm sure he won't start to wait. Michael, all that. They just don't want to. They want to have something else other than politics, you know. And lots of people feel that if you spend 20 years in politics now, or even less, you've given it. Like Simon Comey, in fact, another young man, Michael Creed, they're all, and they're pulled out, and nobody wants to stay now for two. Anyway, that's my decision. It was a personal decision, and I'm absolutely delighted. And the only, I suppose, great benefit I had of staying the extra two elections, the extra 10 years, is that I was appointed a minister for some time, and that I could something as a minister.
Yes, and you did indeed, but you lost that in a reshuffle in 2014.
Because I told them that I wasn't going again.
Yeah. And so you had no issue with that?
Not at all.
Joe McHugh was your replacement.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely.
So you effectively said, look, I'm not going again. If you're reshuffling, that's grand. Put someone else in.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
There was a bit. Would you describe the John McNulty affair, as some would know it, as a bit of a controversy?
I know John very well. And I know that. A good friend of mine was involved in that.
I think
it was a mistake. John McNulty could have been a candidate without being appointed to any board. He would have the qualifications for that, but I think they were just over eager to have extra qualifications. And unfortunately for John and even for the party, it ended up the way it was.
It just looked like a bit of stroke politics, didn't it?
Anyway, and I remember at the parliamentary party meeting, and John was there, and I said he'd be a great candidate, and he was involved in so many things, and football and community and all that sort of thing, but then it blew up. And I can say today, and I don't think I said it publicly before, when it came to the vote, I voted for John.
Right, okay. But that whole controversy and that lack of a natural successor then at that time, it was a big problem for your party, particularly in Donegal South West.
Yes.
You know, you covered and were responsible for a huge swathe of that area, and you were well regarded, you know, deep into the constituency. It just wasn't in your own backyard. Was there any talk or pressure on you again that boat sailed? You weren't coming back again anyway.
No, I wasn't coming back again.
It's too late at that point.
And Yeah, and as I say, when a long-term deputy decides to retire, there's a vacuum there, and it's important to be able to get some. And we had councillors as well, and I always tried to have to make sure that there was someone coming along with me, and in every local election, and I went out of my way to have young people nominated to go for the council. Unfortunately, we had limited success there. Young people, I could name people we had a young man in Creasla, Ian Campbell. We had my own parish. We had Mairead Sweeney. We had Evelyn Sweeney. We had a man in Buttonport, John Murray. We had
Donegal.
We had a footballer, Josh. Young people, I tried to bring them along so that that there'd be something there when I left. But we had limited success, unfortunately.
Mm. What do you put that down to? Was it the fact that you were, you know, you...
It's made, very difficult.
I think to some extent, did you... And I think Pat the Coke Gallagher is very good at this as well. And I mean, this is a compliment that sometimes you are sort of bigger than the party. I don't want to embarrass you, but the fact that, you know, it was a personal vote for Denny, not necessarily just a Fine Gael vote.
Yes, I think we all have personal votes. And when you're there for so many years and you're working, you get to know people and those that you were very available. I did my clinics in your own area. I'd Donegal Town to Glencullum Kill every month, and then there's a fortnight after I'm Donegal Town to Ballyshannon, Bundoran, and out to Petticoat, whether there was anyone there to see me or not. You'd visit a few houses anyway. You'd have a cup of tea here and there. Yeah. And you build up that relationship, and people who wouldn't necessarily have been Fine Gael for personal reasons might do something for them, and they would come along. And then when you retire, I suppose they might drift back to where they came from.
Yeah. And also, too, you saw the
and the same with Pat, you know, he's working, he's down there now, and people go to him, and they needn't be fear of all people at all. But if you do a favour, you know, it's usually returned.
But of course, too, then we had the emergence of the likes of Piers Doherty as well, who became a powerhouse in that region.
Absolutely,
To this day.
I remember very well. The first day he came to school with his mother, and I went to the gate and took him by the hand into the infant class, and I often remind him of that.
And obviously he's a finance spokesperson now. Was he any good at maths? Was he all right?
Well, the year he came to school, I left the following year. So I always had the sixth class of the school, the seniors, and he was down with the infants. But I'm sure, well, he's good at maths now anyway.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Just in relation to the where Fine Gael is in this county now, the county as a whole, as you might say, Joe McHugh's, the timing of his departure, you know, not a huge surprise, but a surprise to some extent. But what really feels apparent as an outsider looking on is that the party's lost an awful lot of ground in this county. And I mean, if you were to sort of say, right, there's an election tomorrow, who are the two candidates? Now, I'm not asking you to name them because that's not really the function of the question. There seems to be a lot of rebuilding or reorganisation of Fine Gael required county-wide. Is that your view as someone that has a better knowledge of it than I might?
Absolutely, absolutely. The votes are gone. As I said, the last time I went in Donegal South West, the last two times, we had 9,500 votes and 8,500 votes. I know in the entire constituency, in the entire county, we have about 7,000 votes. So there's a lot of rebuilding to be done. And I was saddened by the fact that for the first time since the foundation of the state that we didn't have any Fine Gael TD in Donegal. The way
that was significant, wasn't it?
Very significant. Yeah. The way it was, two three-seaters, there was always a Fine Gaeler and maybe two Fianna Fáilers. Then you had the Blaney fam independent. Thomas Gilday came in for a while independent and Thomas Pringle. But that's the way it was. Mm. And it broke a great record. It ended a record anyway. And but now, at least we have two senators in the country. Manus Boyle, who's working very hard. is get a good profile for himself, and you know, has the youth and the energy and the enthusiasm to do it. And then we have Nicky Bradley, who'll be a great asset as well. Unfortunately, Nicky's going through difficult times at the moment for health issues and all that, but I just hope that she will be well soon, that she make a complete recovery and between herself and Manus, that they will together build the organisation back to where it was,
yes,
and that we'll get at one seat in Donegal again.
Yeah, but there does seem even behind them to be vacuums, you know, from the grassroots.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's the same in media. If you're always trying to bring people on, raise their profile, get their knowledge, Manus and Nicky to an extent doing well of that in the Shannon. But, you know, you still need to build new people coming forward.
Yes.
Know? Like, yeah. And there's loads of them that were there that sort of seemed to pitter out or just happened to be in the wrong part of the constituency or outside the constituency. Yeah,
and when I started off, you know, 45 years ago, 1980, 36 years ago, many of the people that I knew along the canvas for me and helped me and advised me, they're no longer with us. Yeah. God rest them. Some of them passed away. Some of them are retired like myself. And you don't have that expertise either. I believe a number of things have to be done anyway. We have to sort of reorganise at grassroots level. And the branches were very important. When I was going, there were about, in my own area, Donegal, South West, there were about 30 branches, you know. And, you go to meetings there, little halls in the middle, late at night, for Glen Cullum Kill or Aidan Infa or Creasle or wherever you were, and there would be maybe half a dozen people there. There might be 20 people there. If you're in Kilcar, there might be 50 people there. And you kept in touch with them that way. And, you know, they felt, you know, it's like a club. Mm. And then they were there for you when the time came and for the election. And they kept you in touch as well with what was going on. And I think we had to go back and to build up the branches again. It's very important. There are 37 councils.
Like, it's not very sexy, but it's what has to happen.
No.
It's tough, like.
It's hard, yeah.
And no, there'll be meetings that you organise and no one will turn up.
I was lucky now. I inherited the seat, you know, from Jim White, and he had the branches there. And I'm not claiming credit for it, but I kept them going. And but a number of things came in. I don't know what happened. But and it's not alone in Donegal, it's another part of the country as well,
sure,
that the branches are not as important as they were, but I believe that they are, should be important. And now I think we'll come back again. I remember the 2002 election when Fine Gael were down to about 20 something seats. Do you remember that? Mm. And then Enda Kenny
ripped them off.
Eh?
Everyone had written them off.
We were almost written off, yeah. And then Kenny came in and he re-energised the parties and all that sort of thing.
I was listening back to an interview I did with Jim White 20, 30 years ago. And he talks of, in that interview, it was released as a podcast actually, but he talks in that interview of this young, new, energetic politician in Enda Kenny, and I just thought it was really quite interesting.
Yes, yeah,
Though, and you reference that now too, yeah.
That's right, and he went through the he visited every constituency at least once, if not twice a year, and he built it up, you know. Gareth Fitzgerald did it, incidentally, as well, in the late 70s, and we need something like that again. And, Greg, it's very difficult for a party to do it when the leading lights of the party are government ministers and have the responsibility of government, and they don't have the time to give to the constituency
and
to organisations.
Sometimes
and
maybe they don't have the, it's not just the time, sometimes maybe they don't have the inclination either.
Yes.
You know, you can get caught up in where you're at. You're one of the longest serving politics in Donegal and will be remembered forever for that. But there's an awful lot of days away, a lot of long weekends where, you know, like, what were you, as far as I'm aware, you never married or had children, right?
No,
So, like, what was the support structure for you?
Yeah, well,
do you know what I mean? Because
first of all, I have great sympathy for TDs or senators even from Cork or Kerry or Donegal or Galway, but about 150 miles away from Dublin, and they had to be away from their families and all that sort of thing. It's so tough for them. And then when we got home on the weekend, you're out in your clinics, you're at community meetings, you're at constituency, whatever it is, there's always, even a Sunday, when I was going, we always have constituency meetings on a Sunday. And if you have a family, that is very difficult. I was, I suppose, fortunate in a way, maybe unfortunate in others, that, I didn't have the responsibility of having children and to be with them. But I do know that TDs now, they miss that, and the families miss it. And that's why they're not prepared to give that time anymore.
And still to this day, we're talking of the need to reform, because obviously now, the truth is women still primarily are the caregivers, and we need to do more so that there's a work-life balance, not just for women and men, but it was a very different time now. But you had good friends and other people in your life, I'm sure, that you could count on when you needed them.
Oh, yes. Yes. I was a teacher, and, I was confined to a small area there, and then all of a sudden you're a TD, and thousands of people, and some colleagues and friends, and it's a different thing altogether, and you've got to be there for them. And I think that's what helped us. That's what helped me anyway, to be available in the country. I always put more emphasis on the constituency than on legislation, to be quite honest with you. And Donegal needed that, because we're so far from Dublin, and people feel that if you go to the TD, you're going to speed things up for them or whatever. And you attend the joyous occasions, and you're there for the sad occasions as well, and you build up that relationship. And I was glad I was able to do that, but it takes time and effort.
National politics has changed significantly. Continental, global politics. How closely do you follow the news agenda around the world?
Well, very, very interested in that now. Very interested. Yeah. What's going on in the world, and it's in turmoil at the moment. When you see what's going on in Europe on our doorstep, when you see what's going on in the States, when you see what's going on, we're in dangerous times, And there are decisions to be made in this country as well,
Well, as we record this, the triple lock conversation.
The triple lock, yes.
As someone who can speak freely, I suppose, outside the party now, what's your views on that?
Well, I was a TD for 25 years, over 20 years, and we had no triple lock. And now it was brought in, I think, in the wake of the Lisbon treaties and that, right? And I'm of the opinion that we can do without it, because it's not fair that these members of the Security Council, whether the Chinese or the Russians or the Americans, can veto our people from going on peacekeeping missions. And Ireland has punches above its weight in the world. We have had peacekeepers for 50 or 60
years. Are you not concerned?
And I highly respect it. And now we can't send more than 12 without getting the imprimatur of the Security Council.
But are you not concerned that whilst that's a very strong argument to get rid of it, there is a concern too, though, that it does lay the groundwork for the potential involvement of the European army or, other conflict? Or do you not have any concerns in that regard? That although it does restrict what we can do in terms of the even going in to rescue people in dire situations, but that maybe that's a price worth paying to keep.
But it didn't affect us when we didn't have the triple lock.
Okay, yeah.
And it didn't affect us. And I think most people in Ireland would be in favour of neutrality. I do not find many politicians of any party advocating that we should join a European army or we can be independent that way.
One question then, so if do you believe then it should be the subject of a referendum? Do you think it's of that significance? Because there's an awful lot of public debate on it.
It's
a big issue.
Yeah.
We could tease out more the ramifications, yay or nay.
Yeah.
Do you think it should be the subject of a referendum?
I don't think we can abandon neutrality without a referendum.
Mm.
I
but
can't
the triple lock.
Happy. I don't think so. No, I don't think so. No, I think no. The government, they're responsible. As I say, we're not giving up our neutrality. We're just sort of doing away with the triple lock that we had for years since we became neutral, right up to the time we were introduced after the Lisbon Treaty.
So, obviously, like I, keeping a good close eye on everything that's happening around the world. Other than that, to go from someone incredibly busy in teaching, incredibly busy in politics, And I'm sure you've plenty to be at right now too. But what do you do? What do you do with your time that you have now for yourself, Denis?
Well, first of all, I do a lot of walking. I try to keep as fit as I can. My target is 14,000 steps a day. Sometimes I get 20,000, which is good. And I'm able to do it. Getting in touch, keeping in touch with my old friends. And unfortunately, some of them have passed away, but some of them are still there. I keep in close contact with some of my former Arthas colleagues. We go off now and again, you know. Last year we were on this, a few of us went on a trip to Egypt and we did the Nile.
Oh, wow.
And a year before that, the year COVID came in, we went and we did South Africa for a month and, brilliant. You know, doing people. I mean, when I was a TD, I had the opportunity to travel as well, of course, all over the place.
It's not the same.
But you go places, you do your business, you come home.
Yeah.
Now you can go and give it your own time and with company, with the people you enjoy. And I'm very fortunate that I have nephews and nieces, and I have sisters-in-law, and they always, if they're going to holidays and all that, we go together as well, you know. And so I'm very happy with that. I'm more relaxing, doing things I want to do, and thankful that I had almost 35 years in the Dáil, got to know so many people, and grateful to the people of Southwestern. Look, I was only their messenger. I was only there to do what I could for them, and I think that I certainly had more, that I made more friends in politics, and I don't think pleased that I did that to make any enemies. And, you know, to be able to leave it in that way, you know, it's a great satisfaction to me. I was very fortunate, you know. People lose their seats, you know, and that's a terrible thing. You have TDs who do lose their seats, they feel bad about
it. It's tough to take.
Yes.
It's a tough thing. Yeah.
It's a tough thing. Yeah. And but I was fortunate that I got that time out of it. And my only regret is now, as I say, that we don't have any representative in the apart from our two senators, of course.
Of course, yeah. And councillors,
and hopefully now in the next election, and particularly if the county is going back to 2-3s, I think that we'd have a very good chance of getting a seat again.
As long as south of Lahey goes into Donegal South.
Yes.
Because it's
crazy. And it's so unfair.
And you talked about missed opportunities. I mean, there's great politicians in that space. That
absolutely.
Hadn't a chance because they're not going to get elected in Sligo.
No. And I always go south of Lahey, Ballinthra, right into Ballyshannon, Mundoran, out of Pettigo. I always got
a good, solid vote there.
You were in that area yourselves,
Yeah.
I don't want to be. Is your father still alive?
No, he
Sylvester.
Passed away. Yeah, he did.
I know. Yeah, but I got to know so many. But that was a very important part there. And we're missing it, and we need it back. Because the people there are neither here nor there.
Yeah. You talked about the one regret about the lack of representation now, notwithstanding those that are there. Do you have any professional regrets about your career? Any decisions that you made or didn't make, or opportunities that you turned down? I see that you're looking intently, so that might mean a no, but maybe there is something there that you just wish maybe you had have made that choice or that decision, or...
I had lots of opportunities in my life, all right, even before I went to politics. I used to work. I had to go abroad as well as an immigrant. And I spent three or four years in Scotland. I remember being there as 70 years of age. I became a bus conductor. And people said to me, "You broke the law." Someone said, "You're not supposed to be working at a bus at 17. But I said, if you're Irish in Glasgow, there are ways and means of overcoming that.
You can talk about it now. I think the Statue of Limitations
is passed. Statue of Limitations. And it was very funny. When I was minister, I was at some function in Glasgow, I think, and I was speaking, and it was a quip, really. I said, you know, there was a Charlie Hoy, you know, he was saying that he introduced free travel for certain... Did you hear this one?
No, go on.
That he introduced free travel for a category of people in Ireland, the first politician to do it. And I was saying, excuse me, I said, I introduced free travel as well for people in Glasgow with Donegal accents. And it was picked up to the Scotsman, and it was featured, and there was an exhibition of Donegal in Scotland, and it was quoted there as well. So you can't see anything. Someone's going to pick it up.
I know. Brilliant. Yeah. Well, it's a good line. Hmm? Good line.
It's a good line, yeah. Yeah. Okay. When you lost a T-shirt and all that, yeah, we got on very well. And my colleagues in Donegal, and both parts of Donegal, we might have our little differences here in the county, but when we went to Dublin, we acted as a team. Which is terrific now.
I was seeing a bit more of a resurgence of that. I'm not saying it didn't happen subsequently, but yeah, it's great to see on issues of common interest, which they all are to some extent, though, that the team are working together. Denny, it's been an absolute pleasure having you in for a conversation. I really, really appreciate it. And it's great to see you so fit, so healthy, and so able to enjoy the retirement, though you're well into it now at this stage. Anywhere that you haven't travelled that's on the bucket list, by the way? Or have you ticked them all?
I've been to Australia, New Zealand and all that, been to South America. Nothing planned in the immediate future. I always like to spend the summer around Donegal.
Yeah. Where
and,
else
you know,
would you go,
and
Denny?
Instead, thank you and Hyatt and Radio Hen for giving me the opportunity. And as to say outside, you're the voice of Donegal.
Okay, well listen, thank you so very much. Denny McGinley.
And a big thank you once again to Denny McGinley for calling in for a chat. We've got some amazing conversations coming up for you in the weeks and months ahead here on the Greg Hughes podcast. So please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and share it out too if you enjoyed it, and help spread the word. Any feedback on the podcast, you can email the researcher and the producer, that's Caroline Orr, and you email her caroline.orr@highlandradio.com. But for me, Greg Hughes and the team, we'll chat to you again real soon.